Hey y'all, this is Sand Dog from Cypress Hill. Check out our new album, Back in Black, Store Near You. And also check out our documentary that's on Showtime. It's running now. And you're checking me out on The Vinyl Guide.
This episode is brought to you by Groove Washer, the best record cleaners and protective sleeves for your vinyl collection. Ask for the Groove Washer from your local shop or go to groovewasher.com. Discount code VinylGuide10. We're also brought to you by AudiophileUSA.com, the family-owned and operated used record shop that only sells excellent and near-mint vinyl records. Over 42,000 titles in stock. Search, dig, and load up your cart with your final vinyl upgrades at AudiophileUSA.com. And now, on with the show.
Well, hey everyone, welcome to episode 342 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record fans and music nerds. And today, we welcome one of the stoned raiders himself, Sendog of Cypress Hill. And man, do we get into it, the early days of Cypress Hill, the expectations of the debut album, the pressures of going into Black Sunday, having multiple albums on the charts at the same time, getting high with Snoop Dogg and the Beastie Boys, the early days, the controversies, the vinyl, the master tapes, Sendog's record collection, dealing with the police, and lots more. Plus, we discussed the new Cypress Hill album, Back in Black, another return to form for Sendog and Be Real. And Back in Black is available now on all streaming services. And of course, vinyl copies can be had in your local record shop. So march on down and give your local record store some love. Grab the new Cypress Hill album, Back in Black, which I understand pairs very well with a gummy. Oh, and real quick, there is an extended version of this interview at our Patreon page, patreon.com/vinylguide. Help support our show and you get extra stuff. Extended interviews, commercial-free interviews, early access to episodes, and lots more. Plus the warm, fuzzy feeling of helping support this show. I love our Patreon supporters. In fact, I'm going to give every single Patreon supporter a shout-out after today's interview, so stay tuned for that. And those of you who haven't joined us up there, you can do that now, patreon.com/vinylguide, and thanks in advance for your support. And finally, if you like Sendog, Cypress Hill, and or the Vinyl Guide podcast, make sure to subscribe for free. We've got hundreds of other episodes you'll enjoy, including episode 320 with comedian and marijuana magnate Tommy Chong, episode 293 with Billy Gibbons of ZZ Top, episode 292 with Guns N' Roses and Velvet Revolver drummer Matt Sorum, episode 289 with Saturday Night Live and Portlandia music nerd Fred Armisen, episode 230 with Robert Trujillo of Metallica, episode 172 with Willie D of the Ghetto Boys, and many, many more. Subscribe to The Vinyl Guide in your podcast app for free. Scroll, listen, and enjoy. And without further delay, let's get into our discussion with Sendog of Cypress Hill. Sendog, how are you, man?
I'm good, my brother. Thanks a lot for asking. I hope you are, too.
I'm doing well. You having a good day? Are you you celebrating the success of the recent record?
You know, it all feels good. It all feels great. You know what I mean? We worked hard on it, and, you know, we keep trying to come up with ways, winning formulas, and whatnot, and you know, when it works out, it's a really good feeling. So yeah, everyone's really stoked. You know, we're all glad that the public, you know, has accepted our new offering.
Were you worried about it at all?
I'll tell you the honest truth, man. I stopped having expectations for our albums after like Till Death Do Us Part. I just like, okay, we'll just make the records. What happens. That happened to coincide with the whole, you know, internet and Napster and all that stuff and everything, and I'm like, kids don't buy records anymore, I don't get it, so we're just gonna put them out, and whoever buys it, whoever doesn't, as long as somebody hears it, whatever, you know. So that was my whole attitude about it up until the new album. And we were like in El Paso or something when we got the news that it had got to number one on iTunes and whatnot, so we were like, yeah, we were high-fiving all across the table and stuff, you know.
Well, it's a marvelous record, and you guys are just killing it. I mean, still, what are we talking about? 30 years on? But I guess you're right. You really don't know what to expect until the record goes out, and so many different things can happen in the meantime. It's hard to worry about something you can't control.
Indeed. And, you know, all we could do is make the art. You know what I mean? That's our job. And the rest is on, you know, everyone else involved in the world that is a fan of music, you know, to get up on it. So, The last few records, I had no expectations for at all whatsoever. I just thought, like, you know, this is the new way of how records sell, whatever. But, you know, we did our homework and we came out with a nice piece and people have responded to it. So I guess I was wrong at some point. You know, I guess this far down the line, so still have that mentality, could have been an error.
I think that's interesting because the longevity of Cypress Hill in an industry where a lot of times bands have popularity for 3 to 5 years and even less sometimes. The fact that you guys are going really strong after 30 years, you still play in stadiums. You guys are on a tour now with Slipknot. That's an incredible feat for you to be able to still be doing that some 30 years on, having a strong brand, putting out the consistently great music that the public enjoys. Maybe this is a tough question, but what's the secret sauce that keeps Cypress Hill going so strong?
Wow, that's a good question, man. I think just the dedication to our craft. And, you know, at one time, you know, we were, you know, a bunch of unemployed kids running around with no money in our pockets, you know, trying to hustle up some rap songs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we were fortunate to get on the right path and get signed and be able to put an album out and be able to start touring and stuff like that. And that's a feat in itself. So I think, you know, you hold on to those accomplishments and keep pushing from there. You know, you don't look back or stuff like that. You got to just keep, you know, keep moving forward and realize that, you know, there's greater artists out there in the world that are never going to get a chance to be heard or anything like that. But you really have to, you know, nurture and take care of what you've accomplished and what you got with these record labels and whatnot, because not everybody gets a chance.
I mean, I assume the band is picky as well. I mean, to keep the quality high, you know, I would assume there's a lot of pressure and review and scrutiny over the various beats and everything that goes into making one of those songs. That concern is there as well.
Well, that's always a concern, yeah. You know, that we're at the top of our game. You know, but this last album that we made, it was kind of like real easy. You know, like every song kept coming out good, and you know, and everything was great. So we just didn't second guess anything, you know, we went with the album that we made, and thanks to a great producer in Black Milk, you know, we're having success with it.
Now, you guys have been doing it for 30 years, and when you started, you were early 20s, so we're all getting up there in age. Are you guys smoking more now, or did you used to smoke more then?
Well, I think there's a difference between then and now. Back then, we used to smoke a lot of, you know, just regular weed, you know, which was fine for the time. But now we smoke a lot of really great weed. So I kind of think that I've added on more smoking through the years. So just to keep myself.
But way more potent stuff as well.
Yeah, way more potent at the same time. Yeah.
Yeah.
The advances that I've made in the field of growing herb is incredible. So
no longer getting that Santa Cruz closet strain. So, being a rapper and smoking a lot of weed, do you have problems with your memory?
No, not really. I don't think so. I do have moments of when I'm trying to think of a movie or an album title or somebody's name and I can't come up with it, and I'm like, damn it, you know. So then at that point, I'll go to Google and get it. I for the most part, I don't think I've damage my brain or anything by smoking pot all these years.
Okay. All right. Well, being a rapper and smoking a lot of weed, do you have problems with your memory?
Oh, man. No, brother.
So we recently had Tommy Chong on the show, and we talked about his proclivities of getting high. Who all have you gotten high with? I'm assuming Tommy Chong, You ever get high with Snoop Dogg or Willie Nelson?
No, I've never met Willie Nelson. I hope to, you know, I hope that I do one day. That would be crazy. But yeah, I've gotten stoned with Snoop before, and you know, and all those and guys like that. You know, when I think about the whole 30 years of us going places and getting high with people, it's probably like a pretty impressive list. But back in the days, 90s, we met the Beastie Boys, and they were just about out of their party phase.
Mm-hmm.
And but Mike D could still smoke some weed, though. And that was a cool experience because I was always such a big Beastie Boy fan.
Who's the funnest to get high with?
I would say Snoop Dogg because he talks a lot of shit. You know what I mean? He has something to say about everything, you know, especially when you're like, you know, watching a basketball game with him or something like that, or, you know, some sports or shit or whatever. And, you know, he's a pretty funny guy in person, like when you hang out with him.
Now, I know that, weed in California is pretty much legal. Is there a level of celebrity weed that isn't available to perhaps the general public that the likes of yourself or Tommy or Snoop get a hold of that's just a completely other level?
Well, you know, all the main players in the game, you know, pretty much have the most, you know, fire weed. And I'm talking, you know, like Be Real and Snoop Dogg and Wiz Khalifa and guys like that. You know what I mean? Like everything that they smoke is top of the line. And I don't know who grows for them or anything, but when we hang, you know, it's a good thing because, you know, they got some of the best weed. And I think Be Real actually has some of like the best weed of anybody that I know.
Mm.
And with his and all that stuff. So, yeah, I would say that there's a little bit of truth to that, you know. I guess the more of a celebrity you are and, you know, the more years that you put into it, you know, the better your circles would be of friends, you know, that are badass growers, you know. So they got the best shit. Why not?
Yeah, yeah. But this isn't stuff like the stuff that Be Real has. This isn't stuff that you get over the counter at a dispensary. This is, you got to know a guy. You got to know who knows a scientist who is able to perhaps get you something. Like it sounds to me like there's probably this whole counterculture that has access to next level stuff that a lot of people struggle to get their hands on.
Yeah, but it's all about who you know. You know what I'm saying? So, if you know the right people in Northern California or, you know, in Colorado or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, it's all about who you know. They're always coming up with new strains and getting better and better. You know, at the smoke that's produced.
All right. So what I'm getting out of this is we need to make friends with Be Real somehow.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
All right. So who's a lightweight? Who have you smoked out and left passed out?
Oh, I mean, you know, back in the days, we used to travel with our big ass pipe Excalibur, like a 7-foot bong or whatever.
Yeah.
And fans that we would come around and they want to hit it and you know, think they could hang or whatever. And I wouldn't call them lightweight, but because they actually hit that bong. But I would say, you know, the lead singer Sublime took a hit at one time and he had to sit down for like 30, 45 minutes and gather his thoughts, you know. Yeah, there's been times when it's not been a good thing, even for ourselves. Like, you know, there's been times when I've hit it and I'm zoned out and I'm like, wait a minute, where's the couch? You know, so yeah, it all depends. I mean, if you come around us and you want to get high, you better know what you're doing. That's all I got to say.
It's important for a man to know his limits. Maybe not these days, but back in the days when you guys were starting out, 90s and whatnot, were you guys ever targeted for a bust? I mean, Cypress Hill would have made an awfully juicy target for cops and feds to make an example out of.
We were never busted. You know, we come across some close calls, you know, with the certain polices around the country. And most of the time, they just want you to throw your weed in the trash can and keep on pushing. You know, for me anyways, you know, we've been in Europe where, you know, things went down at a certain border and we thought we're going to jail for sure, you know. And they come back and say, it's a small matter now. Just let us know if there's any more or else we're going to be pissed off. So I'm like, oh, it's a small matter now. All right. You know, but it's never, I don't think we've been targeted. I think every town that we go to, the cops know we're there. And, you know, there's always a police presence. You know, and I really don't, I don't mind that at all. Where I'm still going to go perform and do what I got to do. It actually makes me feel safe, you know, that there's so many cops there sometimes because they're there to protect and serve, as they say. So, but you definitely feel the tension, you know, sometimes here and there. You know, you go to certain places where, you know, the cops already, you know, maybe their state's already legalized and they don't care. You know, you're smoking weed, it's the law, they could, you could do that. But then you go to other states where it's not really that way, and you know, you get those, you know, looks and tension, you know, those tension feels from you know, from the police and stuff like that. So that lets you know that they're not, you know, we're not at home, we're not at anywhere near like our comfort. I mean, so whatever you do, just know, you know that they're here.
Okay, so you guys have never been specifically targeted by cops or federal agencies over pot, but I'm sure it hasn't always been easy. I mean, now you're very well known, but back in the day as a young man, I imagine that would have been different, yeah?
Yeah. Well, you know, for us growing up in the city of Southgate there, for a while there, the cops had a, you know, pretty big hard on for us because we were, you know, we were a party block on our street, you know? And any given night, there could be 15 to 25 cats in front of my mom's house, you know, drinking 40 ounces and smoking joints and laughing and all that shit to the wee hours of the night. So they were always trying to get up on us and you know, see, you know, if, bring some of us in or whatever. But I just think they had it wrong. You know what I mean? We weren't trying to really sell nothing on that street. We were just smoking weed and stuff like that. And they just couldn't figure it out because it looked like we were like, you know, a gang out there open for business on the street, but it wasn't even like that. It was just, we were just partying. And, you know, and I think the Southgate cops actually have, you know, gave us more sweat altogether combined than, you know, the band has seen professionally in 30 years.
Well, actually that, those early years probably gave you a lot of experience in how to deal with cops later in life.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly true. You know, and I've all, you know, when I've dealt with police, I've tried to be as respectful as possible. I'm not, you know, I ain't going to try to like, you know, talk shit to them or anything like that. You know, tell them what they want to know. And if they want to search the vehicle, go on ahead, knock yourself out, whatever. That approach has worked for me all these years.
I tell you, the two hardest jobs in this world, I think, are being a teacher and being a cop. Those two careers are very much underappreciated. And underpaid.
I agree. Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
Yeah. So when you were young, drinking those 40 ounces, hanging out with your friends, what kind of music were you guys listening to?
We'll be back after these messages.
Well, hey, everyone. I'm here to tell you about AudiophileUSA.com. Used records online that require no guesswork are all in excellent and near mint condition, many of them still sealed. Get your final vinyl upgrades at AudiophileUSA.com. Only the best and cleanest vinyl records. Here, do this now. Jump on their website, AudiophileUSA.com. Quickly search their incredible inventory of over 42,000 vinyl titles by artist, genre, even by record label, and fill up your cart with some glorious used records. Enhance your record collection with the best used records around. That's AudiophileUSA.com. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE. 10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits. When you were young, drinking those 40 ounces, hanging out with your friends, what kind of music were you guys listening to?
You know, there was a different mix, you know, like there was a lot of hip hop in those days, you know, Slick Rick the Ruler and Dougie Fresh, Run DMC, Beastie Boys, Big Daddy Kane, EPMD, KRS-One, you know, King T, HT, all those sounds that were coming out of LA at that point. But on our street too, we have this like you know, we have a multicultural, multiracial thing going on. So, you know, the white kids across the street got me into like Megadeth and really hard metal like that. And I've always been a fan of Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath and Hendrix and Cream and Pink Floyd and stuff like that. That's just growing up from when I was a little kid, you know, and to a young man. I was into rock and roll first because we didn't hear hip hop yet on the West Coast. We had no idea that somewhere in New York, somebody was rapping and scratching records. That didn't, you know, break our circle until like 1980 or like I was like in ninth grade or something like that. I grew up listening to a lot of funk records and soul, blues, and rock and roll. My big sister was into disco, and so I listened to all the BG stuff and all the disco rave, you know, and all that stuff. So there was always some kind of musical things going on around me. You know, my dad is a big salsa guy, so he was always playing like Celia Cruz and Tito Puente and a Gran Combo, you know, and things like that. You know, so there was always music for my ears to reach out to and cling on to, no matter, you know, if I was at home or hanging with my friends, you know.
Mm-hmm. It must have been a very musical house because your younger brother is Mellow Man Ace, as I understand.
Yeah, Mellow Man, yeah. And, he had success in the late 80s. He got signed to Capitol Records, which for us was like, man, we couldn't believe he did that because, you know, you could, you know, you drive down the street from our house and you could pretty much see the Capitol building. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, it was like, it was eye-opening for, you know, the rest of us because they were like, we were like, well, if he could get signed, that means we could get signed. And we just had to work at it and figure out what we were gonna be about, what we were gonna sound and all that stuff. But yeah, Mellow Man, you know. Mm-hmm. The funny thing is that our father raised us up to be baseball players. It was my sisters the ones that got the classical training in piano and all that stuff, and they were the ones that were trying to put music with them. And me and my brother play, you know, sports and shit. And one day we were like, we want to do this rap thing. And then we told our dad, he's like, what the hell is rap? How do you know you're any good at it? So Mello breaking the ice and getting that record deal kind of like took the heat off of my ass with my dad. Because now he knows that, okay, they can do it. It's accomplishable, you know. So let's see what Sen and his guys do. And, but, you know, that's what Mello, it was a groundbreaking thing for us, what he did.
Yeah, yeah. So was he kind of your inspiration for continuing rap? Or who else were you looking towards as the sort of artist you wanted to be?
Well, at that point, it was all about Public Enemy. In those late 80s, you know, mid to late 80 years, as soon as we heard Public Enemy, our minds were blown. And I never wanted to be a solo rapper or anything like that. I always wanted to be part of a crew like Chuck D, Flavor Flav, Terminator X, Professor Griff, the S1Ws. I love that gang look. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So we just had a, you know, gather of our own, and it, you know, it happened to be with after, you know, Mello went solo, you know, then Muggs and I we got Be Real to step in, and we never looked back. You know, so it was all about that, you know, trying to be a, you know, that badass group. And it was a lot of solo guys in those days, LL and Slick Rick and KRS, you know, Big Daddy Kane. But then every now and then you had a dope ass band like EPMD. Bam, you know, there it is. Like, no, that's what I was striving to be like. You know what I mean? Like those guys, like Chuck D and Flavor Flav.
Did NWA come on your radar at all at this time, or was this still earlier than that?
Yeah, right around the same time. I want to say like, yeah, I hope I got my years right. 87, 88, they had a song called Dope Man.
Yeah.
And I remember, I think he rapped the whole song, and it was a big hit on LA radio. They were playing it. They played the shit out of it, you know? And so they were on the radar for sure. I had no idea you know, what was to come from them. But yeah, they were on the radar for sure. But we still, I mean, to me, my favorite hip hop bands of all time are Run DMC and Public Enemy.
So how did you parlay your interest in hip hop into the deal with Rough House?
With Rough House, well, what happened was DJ Muggs had worked with Joe the Butcher on some kind of remix stuff or whatever. I don't know what it was. I can't recall. But Muggs and Joe, you know, built up a friendship or whatever. And I think Muggs had played some Cypress Hill demos for him. And he said, you know, hey, man, it sounds pretty good. And he talked to Chris Schwartz and they wanted to offer us a deal for it. And that's how it started there. And we had other offers, you know, for more money, but there was kind of like restrictions on what we could say and stuff like that. And I was like, no, these guys say, you know, Rough House says we can say whatever the hell we want. So I think it's better that we take that deal. Cause I knew my band, you know, and I knew that B-Real had a lot on his mind that needed to get out, you know what I mean? And I was like, we can't have limits on, you know, can we curse or talk about weed or violence? We can't have limits on that. So that's what led me to like, really, really to be like, hey, I want to roll with these guys, with Joe and Chris at Rough House. Cause you know, they get it. They're punk rock. Like, you know, they don't give a shit. Like, say what you got to say. They don't care. And we're going to put your record. That's how the relationship with Rough House Records started growing from there.
That's really a mature way of thinking. And that takes a lot of guts, because if one organization's offering you, you know, significantly more money, but you make the decision to go with perhaps the lesser deal, but you get more freedom, that's a pretty tough decision, especially for a young man starting out their career. Did you feel pressure? Did you feel any hesitation there?
Well, I felt pressure, but no hesitation, because the guys were kind of, you know, being swayed by, you know, the dollar amounts that these other labels were offering, you know. But at the same time, some guys that were, you know, coming out, dropping records that were really speaking their minds, were coming out, you know, and saying things that have never been said before. And I kind of felt like we had that one of those kind of rappers in the band. So it was all about just having them see that shit. You know what I mean? Like, understand that we're going to, you know, it's better for us to take this deal because of the fact that there's not going to be any tape over our mouth.
Right.
You know, so some convincing, but then, you know, they agreed and we took that deal at Rough House. And,
proved to be right.
For the best.
But that first album, huge. It's still huge. I mean, what were the expectations for it originally?
Originally, when we first got the album done and put it out, and we maybe sold like 60,000 units in like 8 months or something. Mm. But everybody that had heard the album, from like EPMD to the Ghetto Boys, you know, a lot of the New York heads, you know, Q-Tip from Tribe and everybody, they loved that record. And you know, I remember Bushwick Bill told me one day, he goes, man, they sleeping on y'all. They are sleeping. I'm like, yeah, what can I do, man, you know? So the expectations when we first put it out were big, but then nothing followed for many months. And I thought we were about to get dropped. And then all of a sudden, a DJ in New York flipped our single over, which our single was a song called Funky Feel One. And on the B side of it was the Dangerous song, How I Could Just Kill a Man. And that shot to number one in New York. And they took us off a tour with Naughty by Nature to come to New York to, you know, to film videos. And then from there, just sprinkled around the country and got big around the country. And then it went around the world. So finally, the expectations that everyone had, you know, came to fruition. But for a while there, it was like, you know, I felt like we were kind of walking on thin ice for a minute.
You know? Okay. So the label wanted to push the Funky Feel One. Didn't recognize the gold that was on the B side there necessarily. And it took a DJ to either take the initiative to flip it over or to, by happy accidents, play that song instead.
Yeah, I think the partnership, the label was like, put a safe song out there. You know what I mean? It wasn't like, because we were, you know, at that point, some of our material, like I Want to Get High, Stoned Is the Way of the Walk and stuff like that was, you know, it was kind of bold at that time. So, you know, put this song out there, it's safe and everything, whatever. And then as soon as like I Could Just Kill a Man took off, I think every video that followed that was like, you know, edgy and, you know, and contain that, you know, that shit that kids are looking for. They want to, you know, feel part of something exciting, you know? Mm-hmm. So after that, there was no guessing about it. Whatever we put out and it was a hit, no matter what we were saying, the label was putting it out. They didn't even hesitate.
Okay. So in the early days, the record label wasn't asking you to tone down your content, but they were maybe hesitant about you putting it so far up front, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah, I would say so. You know, that's what led to the Funky Feel one, you know, becoming the, you know, the first single out the gate, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, we didn't even have their video. We just had Funky Feel one. That's it. And we went to tour with that video and, you know, and the band, and hopefully, you know, some other bands would put us on, which they did. You know, Third Base took us out. Naughty took us out. We ended up, you know, with the Beastie Boys for a second. But it's all about, you know, the stuff that people don't want to hear sometimes is what is their best medicine. Mm-hmm. You know, and we were those guys. And we were those guys that come out with, you know, and we were proactive marijuana. And people, you know, didn't want to hear that shit. But a lot of people around the world that smoke weed were happy that we came out and we did our thing. You know, because I know that somewhere around this planet, there's millions of people just like me. And those are the ones we were trying to target.
So after the success of the debut album, how difficult was the follow-up? Was there a lot of pressure going into Black Sunday?
Yeah. Because we did 8 months of hardly any record sales. And then the next year, that first album takes off, whatever. And we wanted to, you know, we wanted to do the whole rock star thing, go out on tour and perform and whatnot. So, and we did that. And then we lined up a tour with, I think it was a Warped Tour. Suicidal Tendencies were on it and Eminem was on it. Mm. And the label calls us that we want the album turned in 30 days. And you know, we're young, dude. We don't know fucking better. We didn't know we could have told them like, well, wait, you know, we're going to do this fucking tour or whatever. But so we jumped off that tour and we had a lot of the album done already, but we just finished it and sent it in. And that's where, you know, the whole Insane in the Brain, you know, things started to happen.
So Black Sunday, even though it had been written here and there and you guys have been working on it, it was recorded within a 30-day period with that level of pressure on the delivery date.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, I mean, either I was ignorant to the fact or whatever, or I just didn't feel it or didn't care. We just went and made an album. We had to, you know, we had a lot of stuff we had done in California and then went to New York for, you know, 3 weeks or whatever it was. 3.5 weeks and did the rest and then we turned it in. I was back in those days, I was never worried about anything. Like I kind of felt like, I don't want to say like we were untouchable, but I kind of felt like we had something special that people wanted and okay, well, we'll give it to you when we give it to you. So behind that move of dropping off for that tour to finish the record, our second album comes in at number one, right?
Mm-hmm.
But our first album is still hanging around at number three. And we're like, wow, this is, we got both of our albums in the top 10. We were like ridiculous. We sit there laughing all day about it.
You're like the Stone Beatles.
Yeah. And then, you know, underneath us was like Janet Jackson and like U2 and Madonna. I was like, whoa, this is bizarre.
And yeah, Black Sunday, 4 million copies sold, number one. I think highest sales of a rap group at the time, and of course, you know, gave us Insane in the Brain. The production style of a lot of Cypress Hill has kind of those dirty samples, kind of that grit, which is a signature style. And I think a lot of this is at a time when samples and litigation was still at its infancy. Did Cypress Hill ever get into issues over samples of other artists' work?
Well, you know, we actually, we had a pretty good team when it came to that because, you know, a lot of the stuff that Muggs, you know, would sample actually got cleared up and we got the permission for it to use it correctly. But there was this one label, we used a snippet of a song for maybe 30 seconds as like an interlude on the record. And we found the label, you know, our company paid the label had some money for the rights to use the song. And I guess he didn't tell the artist, but he pocketed the money when the artist found out that we used it because the court. And that one ended up, you know, being quite lengthy of a litigation. Mm-hmm. When those old guys figured out they how the label got money and I didn't get no money, I'm gonna go after those guys. So
got stuck in the middle of that one. Okay.
Yeah. That one for like 14 years or some shit.
Yeah. Now, do you know where all the Cypress Hill tapes are? Do you have control of like all the recordings and all the masters and multi-tracks and that sort of thing?
Like, I don't like have an address on them, but I'm pretty sure I have, you know, where stuff is at, depending on, you know, what year stuff came out on, because after a certain while, you know, the ownership comes back to us or whatever, but I'm sure, you know, there's a vault with a lot of stuff in it.
They weren't part of that Universal Music Fire or anything like that. They do exist somewhere.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I just, hanging with DJ Muggs, I've heard a bunch of old shit that we had done, that's in his control.
Okay. Do you guys have a lot of outtakes or tracks that you did but haven't released, and maybe you'll be some sort of compilation or box set in the future?
I hope so, because after you know, every album that was made, there were some songs that didn't make the cut, and either because there was a lot of other better songs or whatever, but there's quite a few amount of songs that never came out.
Right. Now, Cypress Hill has always had a huge crossover with the rock metal crowd. Why do you think that is?
I think because we grew up that way, you know, in our own areas. Like, we grew up on that level, and in the city where we grew up in Southgate, there was many music scenes, you know, and rock and roll and metal had its own scene there, and I had friends in all those. In all those pockets. So depending on who I hung out with, and that's what we were going to listen to that day. So I think people could see, you know, that there was something different about us. And it's the fact that, you know, we like rock and metal. It's not nothing. I don't think it was nothing weird. Cause you know, we grew up, you know, watching, you know, going to shows and watching bands perform and whatnot. So, and it wasn't always a hip hop band. But to the audience, they were like, well, these dudes are into this and they're into that. And, oh, my God. So I think that's why, you know, they could see it in us that we have those interests.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they could read between the lines very well. And I remember like in 92, we're still touring off of the first album. And I started seeing, you know, guys coming to our concert wearing Guns N' Roses and Black Sabbath t-shirts. I'm like, oh, wow. So that gave me like a clue that, okay, there's something else going on here, because now we got dudes with long hair and Guns N' Roses shirts coming to the Cypress Hill show. And I was like, I think we're crossing genres here. And sure enough, you know, that's what happened. And, you know, those alternative crowds have had our backs for years and they continue to. And I couldn't imagine any other cooler thing scenario to happen for us in that way, because we could set up shop and go on tour and perform with an all hip hop band set, and that's fine and that's great. We love to do that, but we could also, you know, we are the guys that could set up with Nirvana and Pearl Jam and, you know, Soundgarden, and put us in the middle of that, and that's great too, man. That gives you like a whole other, you know, aspect of it is what you do and how big you could take it.
And case in point, right now you guys are about to embark on a tour with Slipknot, which I personally, I think is a match made in heaven. Those are going to be some wild shows.
Yeah, you know, we have quite a long relationship with those guys. You know, and I met them over 20 years ago when they first came out to Cali to record an album, and they were a bunch of young bucks on the scene and whatnot, and they kind of took to us. You know, I was like, hey, you guys are cool, and you know, they're always at the Rainbow Restaurant partying and whatnot. And to actually go on tour with them is a cool thing. But I mean, we've done Cypress Hill Slipknot before around the world. You know, we've done various festivals together and whatnot, and it's always worked out. And I was surprised as hell when the offer came in from those guys, because you know, I've always found them to be truly a truly cutting edge band. And for them, you know, to reach out to us, and you know, we're on album number 10 and year number 30. That's kind of cool. You know, so those are the kind of moments that's the kind of things that, you know, legendary bands kind of moves they make. You know what I mean? So I never thought our band would last 30 years, but it has, and that metal fans would like us, but they do. So it's a double blessing, and you know. And, you know, thanks a lot to Slipknot and everybody from that camp for inviting us out. You know, it means a lot to us.
Absolutely. And tour dates, if folks are interested, can be had at cypresshill.com, as well as links to vinyl copies of the new LP, Back in Black. There's some merch up there. Grab yourself a bucket hat, cypresshill.com. Before you go, Sendog, let me ask you this. This is a vinyl record podcast. We haven't talked too much about records so far. Do you have a record collection?
I do. I do. I have like, I really do. I have like somewhere around 21 or 22 crates of records that I've collected through the years. Some of the stuff that I took from my house when my parents moved out and my dad didn't want it anymore, I put them all together. And for a long time there, even if I saw like a yard sale and had a crate of records, I'd go out and get them. You know, I didn't care what was in them, whatever, you know, but I've been able to find some really cool shit, you know, through collecting records.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. So you still have the records of your youth, the ones you actually played as a kid.
Yeah. I still have the very first album my dad bought me when I was like 11 years old. And I was big into Cameo, Knights of the Sound Table. And I never asked him for shit, you know, because. You know, my dad wasn't that go splurge money and spoil you guys, that dude, you know? So, my birthday came up and he's like, what do you want for your birthday? You want to go eat somewhere? I go, no, I want this record. And I didn't get a present or anything else. We didn't go eat or anything like that. I got that record and I played the hell out of it.
And so when you were a kid, records were really important to you. Where did you get your records? You and your brothers and sisters, how did you accumulate records?
There was an ice cream shop next to my mom's job. And inside that ice cream shop, they had like, they would sell 45s, right? So me and my brother basically would starve ourselves at school during the week and not eat to have like, at the end of the week, like 10 bucks to go to the store and buy some records. And then there was the store in Southgate called Uri's Records, and they were a big supporter of anything hip hop in those early years. So we used to go to that store too and buy records there, and because they, you know, you could buy you know the Police and Santana or whatever, you could buy those records everywhere, but trying to find those hip hop records, you had to go to like a special place.
And do you still shop for records? Like what's your local record shop now?
Well, actually I haven't seen a record shop in a long time, but you know, I no longer, you know, go out of my way to, you know, find records at this point. But if I'm somewhere and I don't got to walk far or whatever to, you know, I'll go in there and grab some records. And like, we did an interview over at Amoeba, Bobo and I, and then we went shopping afterwards. So I picked up a bunch of cool, you know, classical rock stuff and some funk records that I've been wanting to get. So, but you know, in my area here, there's no record store anymore.
Look, Sendog, I think we're about ready to wrap up. Is there anything you want to talk about we haven't covered yet?
Man, I just want to, you know, say, you know, a big thank you to all the fans that have stuck behind us through all these years and everything that the band has gone through. And they've never wavered. They've been there every time. Album, new album out or not, they show up at the concerts, they buy the merch. And it's a beautiful thing to have, you know, a fan base like that to back you up. You know, what more can you ask for as a professional band is to, you know, have loyal fans. And our fans are definitely loyal, and I'm very proud of that. And that's why we keep coming back at them.
All right. Well, Sendog, thank you so much for coming on The Vinyl Guide again. Cypress Hill is one of the most beloved, I won't even say hip-hop bands, just beloved bands, certainly of my lifetime. And the fact that you guys are still around some 30-plus years later, making great albums, Back in Black, to me, is just as great as any of the other works that you've done throughout. The consistency is high. Cypress Hill always delivers. I'm going to ask people to head over to cypresshill.com. Check out the tour dates. There's a tour going on with Slipknot. Also, you can check out the new album, Back in Black. Vinyl copies are out there. It's on all streaming services. Crank it up. Listen to it. Enjoy. Try before you buy, but then grab a copy of Back in Black on vinyl at your local record shop. If they don't have it, bug them until they do get it. Also, check out the merch, cypresshill.com. Again, t-shirts, bucket hats, everything there to help help enrich your attire and keep the Cypress Hill machine going. Again, Sendog, thank you so much for coming on the show, mate.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for the kind words.
There we go, Mr. Sendog of the mighty Cypress Hill. We wish him well. We've recently heard that there's been some health issues and he's been missing a few shows off their tour. So we wish him well and back up on his feet as quickly as possible. And a quick reminder that we have an extended interview, an extended version of our conversation up at our Patreon page, patreon.com/vinylguide. Go up there and support us now. Of course, you get early access to episodes, commercial-free episodes, extended interviews, and heaps more. Plus, I'm about to give shout-outs to all our Patreon subscribers right now. So here we go. Huge thanks and shout outs to George Stoyle, Adam Lagesson, Jackson Bassett, Lars Feller, Annie Perkowski, Eric Shipley, Jonathan Goltz, Bobby Burcham, Zev Feldman, Jim, Shane Hunter, Lee Ving, Andrea Safani, Tony, Chris Moyer, Matt Walsh, Anthony L. Steshik, I guess that's a Stesh, Anthony L. Steshik, I guess that's how you pronounce it. Huge shout out to Nigel Champion, Scott Tice, Ryan Sigworth, Stefan, Chris Rosendell, Matthew Rusick, Daniel Johnson, Mark Aravello, Seth Madidge, Mark Dietz, Scott, Andrew Mills, Paul Van Inns, Ray, Danny, Oyvind Mobeck, CJ Marciano, Steve Chase, Ben Dixon, Jed Bedouin, Mark Valoria, Tabitha Torrance, Deborah Enos Clark, David Shanks, Brian Kane, William Ryan Baker, Corey Baker, Jeremy Price, Rob Freeman, Ryan Nims, Alan Lustowska, Christopher Theas, Rob Giles, Parker Macy, Derek King, TJ, Gene Bartum, Aaron Goodrich, Caitlin O'Connor, Sam Cohen, Miguel Alvarez, Carolina Hildago, Patrick Thompson, Eric Lands, Tommy No Shoes, Christian Nayas, Jason Jabara, Gregory Plass, Mike McGlinnan, Bruno Bissonette, Tom Grover Beery, Chuck Boyd, Declan Phoenix, David Wellbeloved, Dan T, Kevin Mosher, David Phillips, Reg, Michael Howerton, John Lilliquist, David Messer, Tim Clifford, Jen Di Eugenio, Timo Christofferson, Sean Kenny, Nicholas Poulot, Jose Marcel Berto de Souza, and Sean Kelly. Thank you all so much, guys. You are amazing. You're wonderful. Thank you so much for your support. I hope you're enjoying all the extras up there. Everyone else, you could join this list of wonderfully handsome individuals supporting The Vinyl Guide by heading up to patreon.com/vinylguide. Help us support this show, and that's a huge help to keeping this going. Thank you, everyone. You guys absolutely rock. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media. Share them on Facebook, tweet them out on Twitter, tell your friends about them. That is always a huge help. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.